Welcome to the Woodridge Baptist Church podcast. For more information about what's happening in the life of our church, visit our website at www.woodridge.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Hey, I just want to jump in. Let's go to Mark chapter 1 and let's read it, verses 9 through 11, and see what the Lord wants to teach us today. Here's what it says. It says, at that time, Jesus came from Nazareth in Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. And just as Jesus was coming up out of the water, he saw heaven being torn open and the Spirit descending on him like a dove. And a voice came from heaven, "You are my Son, whom I love, and with you I am well pleased." Boy, there's actually a lot in this passage, but one of the things I think is interesting about Mark is this is an interesting place to begin. Mark's gospel is a bit different. You read some of the other gospels and it talks about angels that appear to Mary and God has found favor with you. And then they go through the birth of Jesus and all this. Mark wasn't like this. Mark starts, he's like, let's just get right to the ministry of Jesus. And before the ministry begins, he gives an example of what it means to follow his Father and to be baptized. Now, he wasn't being baptized so that he could be saved from anything. Jesus didn't need that. We need that. There was something else that was going on here, and I hope to make a little bit of sense out of that for you today, but Mark is a focused writer. I mean, everything with Mark is like, and then they did this, and then they did this. It's like, boom, boom, boom. And he's just trying to tell the story of the life and ministry of Jesus. He has a goal. But what was his goal in this? And the answer is he wants you to know that Jesus is God's son. He wants you to know that. And not just like in your head to know that, but in your heart to know what that means for you. And there are different meanings of that, especially given what Mark was going through at the time that he was writing this. So, for example, one of the meanings, what does it mean to talk about Jesus as God's son? There's kind of a political meaning to this. At the time that Mark was writing his gospel, there was a guy named Nero, and he was the one that was the Caesar. He was an interesting guy. I wouldn't like to say that he's a great guy. He struggled with good life decisions, if you understand what I'm saying. But by tradition, listen to some of the things that Nero did. He would take Christians, he would sew them into the skins of animals, and then he would feed them to other animals. He was also known for dipping Christians in wax, lighting them on fire, and then he would ride his chariot around them as they were burning. And he would say, "You are the light of the world. You are the light of the world." Obviously making fun of one of the ways that the early Christians described themselves, and one of the ways that Jesus told us that we ought to be, we're to be the light of the world. He also had his own mother killed, so that's kind of bar raising. But it wasn't just that. He also had just a smidgen of a God complex. He required people as they would go into the temple, and he would require them to take a pinch of incense and to say that Caesar is Lord as they were going into what was meant to be a place of worship. He's like, "It is, you'll worship me." All of this is going on as Mark is writing his gospel. It's just, Mark wants to say something a little bit different. You claim that about yourself, it's just, you're wrong. There is a Lord and it isn't you. There is a Son of God and it isn't you. It's somebody else. So this, what we just read here in three verses, partly has that in mind. But it's more than that. There was a meaning that had to do with Israel as well. Throughout the Old Testament, God referred to Israel as his son. You find it just over and over and over again. Israel, you are my son. Let me give you just one example. In Exodus chapter 4, verse 22, it spoke to the Pharaoh. And you remember the people had been enslaved, and he sends, Moses to say, "You're going to be leading my people out." But notice the way that God's people are described in Exodus 4:22. To the Pharaoh, "Let my son go that he may worship me." This is how his people were known, were as his son. What Jesus is doing is he's breaking the narrative. He's looking at what Israel was meant to be. You were meant to be a light to the nations. You were meant to be the ones that give the message of hope and salvation, and you failed. And Jesus says, "You did, but I won't. I'm the new Israel." So when he says that he is the Son of God, it has that meaning in mind as well. But then there's the personal meaning. It says something about Jesus's identity. To be called a son meant, back then, it meant to be considered equal in nature with somebody else. And in this case, it's talking about equal in nature with God. And they would have understood that that's exactly what it meant. Jesus is a human, but he's no mere human. He is also divine. And they pick up on that message. Now, here's the thing. Anybody can claim to be divine. I could do it right now if I wanted to. I just don't. I don't know if you know this. There is actually in Russia, there is a community that has gathered. They've secluded themselves. They're actually worshiping at the feet of a man that says he is the second coming of Jesus. They're vegans and all this other kind of thing. Now, he's made that claim about himself, but you might want to like push a little bit and say, now, how would I actually know that somebody is divine and somebody isn't? That's why this passage actually matters, because things happened around Jesus that proved it. Look at it. The heavens were torn open. The Spirit of God came down like a dove, and the Father speaks blessings over his Son. It wasn't just a matter of Jesus making a claim about himself. It was being revealed about Jesus to everyone that was around him. The Jewish prophets had been using this language, talking about the Son of God, to describe when the Messiah would come to save a broken and messed up world. There's one that's going to come, and he's going to put this place back together. Notice it said that a dove, something like a dove, descended upon him. This language, this imagery goes all the way back into Genesis. If you read the Targum, which was written in Aramaic, and it's an Aramaic translation of the Bible, you go back into Genesis, and at the time of creation, it said that there was a dove that descended over the chaotic waters. Now you look in Mark chapter 1, and you have Jesus who's going into the water, and a dove comes down over him as he comes out of the water. You see a picture here? Because in Genesis, it's God taking chaos and disorder, and he's putting it back together again. And notice in Mark chapter 1, he's going to do something through Jesus, which is to take all of the chaos and the disorder, and there's just a little bit of that out there right now, wouldn't you agree? And he says, but there's a way to put this all back together again. It's the same thing from Genesis 1 all the way to Mark chapter 1. Even there's this work called the Testament of Levi. I know you all read it this week, but I just want to read from it for a second for you, because this goes back into the second century BC, before Christ. Listen to what it says. It says, the heavens shall be opened, and from the temple of glory shall the sanctification come upon him with the Father's voice, as from Abraham, the father of Isaac. And the glory of the Most High shall be uttered over him, and the spirit of understanding and of sanctification shall rest upon him, watch it, in the water. 200 years before this happens, in Mark's gospel, the Testament of Levi spoke once again, God is going to reveal himself, and you'll see it witnessed in this moment right here. The heavens are torn. By the way, that word for torn, it's schizo, and just so you know, yes, it connects to what you think. If you're minimally awake, you probably made that connection this morning. You probably thought of something like schizophrenic. The word actually means to divide or to split or to rip apart. And notice in Mark chapter 1, it says the heavens just went whoop and ripped apart. In other words, this is the moment, and the hope has come. How many of you are J.R.R. Tolkien fans? Can I see those hands out there? I mean, the Lord of the Rings, am I the only one? Do you know who I'm talking about? Y'all got to go read a book. That's all I'm saying. All right, so you have the trilogy of the Lord of the Rings. Now, Tolkien, one of the reasons I like him is, well, he was just a great writer. Tolkien was also instrumental because one of his good buddies was C.S. Lewis, and he was one of the guys that was instrumental in leading C.S. Lewis to Christ. It's that guy. But he wrote these books so that you could have like an allegory of the Christian story, that you could picture it in your mind's eye through literature. And there's this moment, for those of you that have read it, it's the Battle of Helm's Deep. Or how about this? For those of you that saw the movies, we'll do that too. For those of you that saw the movies, there's the Battle of Helm's Deep, and you have Aragorn, and you have all the guys, and they're trapped. There's really nowhere to go. And around the castle, you have these orcs, and man, they're rough-looking creatures. You know, the slimy skin, they're all ripped. It's like they haven't missed leg day. You know, they're massive, slimy skin. They've got this jagged teeth, and they all have that voice. They're all like that. And Aragorn and the good guys, they're trapped in the fortress. There's only really one way out, but there had been a promise that was given to them before this moment. No, this is a fortress that's to be defended. And there was this guy named Gandalf. Y'all know who I'm talking about? Gandalf. And he says, at the darkest moment, you look to the east. And this was that moment. They're looking out and they're completely surrounded. And they know that the only way out is to go and fight through the darkness. And so let's go to the movies. In the movies, there's, you know, the trumpet blasts and they open the gates and they go running out on horseback and everything. And they're killing the orcs as they go. But there's just like skillions of them out there. And then Aragorn looks up to the hill and who's there? Gandalf is there. And with him comes an army to fight with them. And boom, they descend down the hill. Are y'all going to go watch it now? And they descend down the hill and he's got this staff. And when he goes boom and hits the ground, light just goes and all of the orcs and all of the darkness basically just drop because they can't handle the power of the moment with Gandalf. That's this moment. The heavens split and hope is here. God is doing something that cannot be undone. By the way, the same word, I love this in Isaiah chapter 64, verse 1, where well before Jesus, notice what Isaiah said, "Oh, that you would tear the heavens and come down. Come fix this place." And Jesus says, "I'm here. I'm here." So this root word for schizo, it's also used at the crucifixion of Jesus when the veil of the temple was torn in two from the top to the bottom. Can you imagine being there? The veil that separated the inner court from the Holy of Holies was torn. And just so you know, this was like no normal veil. This isn't like the drapes that you have at your windows. It's much more impressive than that. 60 feet tall, 30 feet wide, 10 inches thick. Can you imagine trying to rip this thing? It's massive. You couldn't do it. And there at the death, it rends right in half. To put this thing, it took dozens of priests to put this thing up. But why was that veil so important? And the answer is, it symbolizes that you could not get to him. There is a separation here. Sin put us apart. No one could go into this space except for once a year. Once a year, you'd have the high priest that could go in on the Day of Atonement. One time. Notice the difference though. At Jesus' death, what he's saying is, you might not could have come to me, but I knew that. And so I came to you. I came to you. See this connection here. Here we are at the beginning of Mark's gospel. And you have the heavens that are tearing apart and the Spirit descends on Jesus. You go to the end of Mark's gospel and the veil is torn and God comes to all of the people. From the beginning all the way to the end. And notice what the Father says in verse 11. He says, "You're my son. You're my son whom I love. With you I'm well pleased. You're beloved." He's saying something, and if you think about the ministry of Jesus, there's a lot of suffering ahead of him, isn't there? There's a lot. And the Father is saying, "My love for you is unconditional. So even though you're about to go through quite a bit, I want you to remember my love for you is unconditional." I think sometimes in our suffering, we can lose that. I want you to remember this moment in the life of Jesus. He says, "I'm well pleased with you. I fully delight in you." But this is drawing from something. This is actually drawing from a Jewish tradition that I think is a beautiful tradition, and maybe more families could pick this thing up. Before a father at that time died, they would meet with each child and they would speak blessings over them. They would speak favor over them. They would speak affirmation over them. This is kind of the toggling that a parent gets to go through, because on the one hand, you have to guide the child, you have to correct the child. On the other end, you're hoping the child is receiving it. That's a part of the work that we do. But notice from this moment in the life of Jesus, in this beautiful practice in Jewish custom and tradition, speak blessings over your children. We need that. We need this. One of the worst things in that culture was to miss out on a father's blessing. It was one of the worst. And here you have the father looking at the son, and he says, "I'm fully pleased in you. I'm fully pleased." Parents, I'm just putting this out there. When is the last time you said a word like that to your kids? "I'm proud of you." But it's not just that. This is the moment of Christ's baptism. And so he wasn't being saved from sin. He didn't need that. In a moment, we're actually going to be celebrating baptism. But we need to be thinking about what baptism actually is for us today. I mean, if Jesus models it for us, then what is it that we're supposed to pull from this and why it matters so much? And there's an ordering of things. You come to Jesus first and you go through the water second. You come to Jesus by faith, you go through the water by obedience, because he's the one that put it into place. We saw it right here. But there's this phrase that you see in Scripture, and I'm just going to give you a few examples on why this matters. He says, "You have passed through the water." You've passed through the waters. Let me give you just a couple examples. In Genesis chapter 6, verse 8, it says, "The heavens split and the waters poured over the earth and destroys evil people." But there was this one guy, you remember him, his name was Noah, and it says that he was delivered through the chaotic waters, through the water. If you go over to the book of Exodus, all you gotta do is jump one more book over. God delivers the Israelites from slavery, and it says he delivered them through the water. And you go, why does this actually matter? Because even here in Mark's gospel, John the Baptist has people and he's baptizing them in water. And the reason that it matters is because for them, the water symbolized something. What the waters symbolized was chaos and death. You will pass through chaos and death, but you pass into something else. You pass into something new. You pass into life. You leave chaos and disorder and you go back in to God's way of life. You go back in to order. That's what all this is about. And this is the choice that you make, because do you notice where this happened? It says he baptized him in the Jordan River. Now the Jordan River actually means something. I've been in it. But back then, this was the cusp of the wilderness, which is basically the place that they were roaming, and it was chaotic, and they were separated. They were waiting for God to fulfill a promise to them. And then there's this line that the Jordan, and on the other side was a promised land. In essence, this is basically what it's saying. You can make a choice that you can continue to roam out into the wilderness, or you can pass through the water, and you can go into a place of promise, and you can go to a place of blessings. That choice is yours. If you go into Exodus, it took them a hot minute to get there, didn't it? You know, it shouldn't have taken 40 years. I mean, it's like an 11 days journey. 40 years later, and you're like, what in the world? But I'll be honest with you, I'm not that different from those people. It's like, spiritually speaking, there are parts of me that are kind of still in the wilderness, and there are parts of me that are standing in the, it's the parts I just don't want to hand over. Does that resonate with you at all? Today can be a day of decision, is all I'm saying. Jesus isn't hiding himself from you. Mark isn't hiding who Jesus is for you. He's the sinless Son of God who died on a cross to defeat death and sin. He's the one that is willing to descend into the pit of hell and beat it from the inside out. And he was willing to do that for you. I don't know about you, but the way I look at it is, that's a lot of love. What do you think? What do you think? This morning, the only question that we have left is, what are you going to do with Jesus? The question isn't, what has Jesus done for you? It is not, what has Jesus done for me?
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about our church, visit www.woodridge.org.